Alvin said. You know she's not. You know that's just their game, their way, maybe, of laughing in the dark. In the dark is correct, Charles continued. They want us to go on being confused instead of properly organized. Meg shook her head violently. No, she shouted. I know our world isn't perfect, Charles, but it's better than this. This isn't the only alternative. It can't be. Nobody suffers here, Charles intoned. Nobody is ever unhappy. But nobody's ever happy either, Meg said earnestly. Maybe if you aren't unhappy, sometimes you don't know how to be happy. Calvin, I want to go home.
We can't leave Charles, Calvin told her. And we can't go before we found your father, you know that. But you're right, Meg, and Mrs. Witch is right. This is evil.
Charles Wallace shook his head, and scorn and disapproval seemed to emanate from him.
Come, we're wasting time.
He moved rapidly down the corridor, but continued to speak.
How dreadful it is to be low, individual organisms.
His pace quickened from step to step, his short legs flashing, so that Meg and Calvin almost had to run to keep up with him.
Now see this, he said.
He raised his hand, and suddenly they could see through one of the walls into a small room. In the room, a little boy was bouncing a ball. He was bouncing it in rhythm, and the walls of his little cell seemed to pulse with the rhythm of the ball. And each time the ball bounced, he screamed as though he were in pain.
That's the little boy we saw this afternoon, Calvin said sharply.
The little boy who wasn't bouncing the ball like the others.
Charles Wallace giggled again.
Yes, every once in a while there's a little trouble with cooperation, but it's easily taken care of. After today, he'll never desire to deviate again. Ah, here we are.
He moved rapidly down the corridor and again held up his hand to make the wall transparent. They looked into another small room or cell. In the center of it was a large, round, transparent column, and inside this column was a man.
Father!
Meg screamed. Chapter 9. It. Meg rushed at the man imprisoned in the column, but as she reached what seemed to be the open door, she was hurled back as though she had crashed into a brick wall. Calvin caught her.
It's just transparent like glass this time, he told her. We can't go through it.
Meg was so sick and dizzy from the impact that she could not answer. For a moment, she was afraid that she would throw up or faint. Charles Wallace laughed again, the laugh that was not his own, and it was this that saved her. For once more, anger overcame her pain and fear. Charles Wallace, her own, real, dear Charles Wallace, never laughed at her when she hurt herself. Instead, his arms would go quickly around her neck and he would press his soft cheek against hers in loving comfort. But the demon, Charles Wallace, snickered. She turned away from him and looked again at the man in the column.
Oh, Father, she whispered longingly.
But the man in the column did not move to look at her. The horn-rimmed glasses, which always seemed so much a part of him, were gone, and the expression of his eyes was turned inward, as though he were deep in thought. He had grown a beard, and the silky brown was shot with gray. His hair, too, had not been cut. It wasn't just the overlong hair of the man in the snapshot at Cape Canaveral. It was pushed back from his high forehead and fell softly almost to his shoulders, so that he looked like someone in another century or a shipwrecked sailor. But there was no question, despite the change in him, that he was her father, her own beloved father.
My, he looks a mess, doesn't he? Charles Wallace said and sniggered.
Meg swung on him with sick rage.
Charles, that's father, father.
So what?
Meg turned away from him and held out her arms to the man in the column. He doesn't see us, Meg, Calvin said gently.
Why? Why?
I think it's sort of like those little peepholes they have in apartments in the front doors, Calvin explained. You know, from inside you can look through and see everything, and from outside you can't see anything at all. We can see him, but he can't see us.
Charles, Meg pleaded, let me in to Father.
Why?
Charles asked placidly. Meg remembered that when they were in the room with the man with red eyes, she had knocked Charles Wallace back into himself when she tackled him and his head cracked the floor. So she hurled herself at him. But before she could reach him, his fist shot out and punched her hard in the stomach. She gasped for breath. Sickly, she turned away from her brother, back to the transparent wall. There was the cell, there was the column with her father inside. Although she could see him, although she was almost close enough to touch him, he seemed farther away than he had been when she had pointed him out to Calvin in the picture on the piano. He stood there quietly, as though frozen in a column of ice, an expression of suffering and endurance on his face that pierced into her heart like an arrow.
You say you want to help, Father?
Charles Wallace's voice came from behind her with no emotion whatsoever.
Yes, don't you?
Meg demanded, swinging around and glaring at him.
But, of course, that is why we are here.
Then what do we do?
Meg tried to keep the franticness out of her voice, trying to sound as drained of feeling as Charles, but nevertheless ending on a squeak.
You must do as I have done and go into it, Charles said.
No.
I can see you don't really want to save Father.
How will my being a zombie save Father?
You will just have to take my word for it, Margaret,
came the cold, flat voice from Charles Wallace.
It wants you, and it will get you. Don't forget that I, too, am part of it now. You know I wouldn't have done it if it weren't the right thing to do.
Calvin, Meg asked in agony, will it really save Father?
But Calvin was paying no attention to her. He seemed to be concentrating with all his power on Charles Wallace. He stared into the pale blue that was all that was left of Charles Wallace's eyes.
And for thou wast a spirit too delicate to act her earthy and abhorred commands, she did confine thee into a cloven pine, he whispered,
and Meg recognized Mrs. Hu's words to him. For a moment, Charles Wallace seemed to listen. Then he shrugged and turned away. Calvin followed him, trying to keep his eyes focused on Charles's.
If you want a witch, Charles, he said, it's the witch, not Our Lady's. Good thing I had the tempest at school this year, isn't it, Charles? It was the witch who put Ariel in the cloven pine, wasn't it?
Charles Wallace's voice seemed to come from a great distance.
Stop staring at me.
Breathing quickly with excitement, Calvin continued to pin Charles Wallace with his stare.
You're like Ariel in the cloven pine, Charles, and I can let you out. Look at me, Charles, come back to us.
Again, the shudder went through Charles Wallace. Calvin's intense voice hit at him.
Come back, Charles, come back to us.
Again, Charles shuddered. And then it was as though an invisible hand had smacked against his chest and knocked him to the ground, and the stare with which Calvin had held him was broken. Charles sat there on the floor of the corridor, whimpering, not a small boy's sound, but a fearful animal noise.
Calvin,
Meg turned on him, clasping her hands intensely,
try to get to Father.
Calvin shook his head.
Charles almost came out. I almost did it. He almost came back to us. Try Father,
Meg said again.
How? Your cloven pine thing. Isn't Father imprisoned in a cloven pine even more than Charles? Look at him in that column there. Get him out, Calvin.
Calvin spoke in an exhausted way.
Meg, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get in. Meg, they're asking too much of us. Mrs. Who's spectacles, Meg said suddenly. Mrs. Hu had told her to use them only as a last resort, and surely that was now. She reached into her pocket, and the spectacles were there, cool and light and comforting. With trembling fingers, she pulled them out.
"Give me those spectacles!"
Charles Wallace's voice came in a harsh command, and he scrambled up off the floor and ran at her. She barely had time to snatch off her own glasses and put on Mrs. Hu's, and as it was, one earpiece dropped down her cheek and they barely stayed on her nose. As Charles Wallace lunged at her, she flung herself against the transparent door, and she was through it. She was in the cell with the imprisoning column that held her father. With trembling fingers, she straightened Mrs. Hu's glasses and put her own in her pocket.
"Give them to me,"
came Charles Wallace's menacing voice, and he was in the cell with her, with Calvin on the outside pounding frantically to get in. Meg kicked at Charles Wallace and ran at the column. She felt as though she were going through something dark and cold, but she was through.
"Father,"
she cried, and she was in his arms. This was the moment for which she had been waiting, not only since Mrs. Witch whisked them off on their journeys, but during the long months and years before, when the letters had stopped coming, when people made remarks about Charles Wallace, when Mrs. Murray showed a rare flash of loneliness or grief. This was the moment that meant that now and forever, everything would be all right. As she pressed against her father, all was forgotten except joy. There was only the peace and comfort of leaning against him, the wonder of the protecting circle of his arms, the feeling of complete reassurance and safety that his presence always gave her. Her voice broke on a happy sob.
"Oh, Father! Oh, Father!"
"Meg!" he cried in glad surprise.
"Meg, what are you doing here? Where's your mother? Where are the boys?"
She looked out of the column, and there was Charles Wallace in the cell, an alien expression distorting his face. She turned back to her father. There was no time for greeting, for joy, for explanations. "We have to go to Charles Wallace," she said, her words tense. "Quickly!" Her father's hands were moving gropingly over her face, and as she felt the touch of his strong, gentle fingers, she realized with a flooding of horror that she could see him, that she could see Charles in the cell and Calvin in the corridor, but her father could not see them, could not see her. She looked at him in panic, but his eyes were the same steady blue that she remembered. She moved her hand brusquely across his line of vision, but he did not blink.
"Father," she cried, "Father, can't you see me?"
His arms went around her again in a comforting, reassuring gesture.
"No, Meg."
"But, Father, I can see you."
Her voice trailed off. Suddenly, she shoved Mrs. Hu's glasses down her nose and peered over them, and immediately she was in complete and utter darkness. She snatched them off her face and thrust them at her father.
"Here!"
His fingers closed about the spectacles.
"Darling," he said, "I'm afraid your glasses won't help."
"But they're Mrs. Hu's, they aren't mine,"
she explained, not realizing that her words would sound like gibberish to him.
"Please, try them, Father, please."
She waited while she felt him fumbling in the dark.
"Can you see now?" she asked. "Can you see now, Father?"
"Yes," he said. "Yes, the wall is transparent now. How extraordinary! I could almost see the atoms rearranging."
His voice had its old familiar sound of excitement and discovery. It was the way he sounded sometimes when he came home from his laboratory after a good day and began to tell his wife about his work. Then he cried out,
"Charles! Charles Wallace!"
And then,
"Meg, what's happened to him? What's wrong? That is Charles, isn't it?"
"It has him, Father," she explained tensely. "He's gone into it. Father, we have to help him." For a long moment, Mr. Murray was silent. The silence was filled with the words he was thinking and would not speak out loud to his daughter. Then he said,
"Meg, I'm in prison here. I have been for—"
"Father, these walls,
You can go through them. I came through the column to get into you. It was Mrs. Hu's glasses.
Mr. Murray did not stop to ask who Mrs. Hu was. He slapped his hand against the translucent column.
It seems solid enough.
But I got in, Meg repeated. I'm here. Maybe the glasses help the atoms rearrange. Try it, Father.
She waited, breathlessly, and after a moment, she realized that she was alone in the column. She put out her hands in the darkness and felt its smooth surface curving about her on all sides. She seemed utterly alone, the silence and darkness impenetrable forever. She fought down panic until she heard her father's voice coming to her very faintly.
I'm coming back in for you, Meg.
It was almost a tangible feeling as the atoms of the strange material seemed to part to let him through to her. In their beach house at Cape Canaveral, there had been a curtain between the dining and living room made of long strands of rice. It looked like a solid curtain, but you could walk right through it. At first, Meg had flinched every time she came up to the curtain, but gradually she got used to it and would go running right through, leaving the long strands of rice swinging behind her. Perhaps the atoms of these walls were arranged in somewhat the same fashion.
Put your arms around my neck, Meg, Mr. Murray said. Hold on to me tightly. Close your eyes and don't be afraid.
He picked her up, and she wrapped her long legs around his waist and clung to his neck. With Mrs. Hu's spectacles on, she had felt only a faint darkness and coldness as she moved through the column. Without the glasses, she felt the same awful clamminess she had felt when they tessered through the outer darkness of Kamazots. Whatever the black thing was to which Kamazots had submitted, it was within as well as without the planet. For a moment, it seemed that the chill darkness would tear her from her father's arms. She tried to scream, but within that icy horror, no sound was possible. Her father's arms tightened about her, and she clung to his neck in a stranglehold, but she was no longer lost in panic. She knew that if her father could not get her through the wall, he would stay with her rather than leave her. She knew that she was safe as long as she was in his arms. Then they were outside. The column rose up in the middle of the room, crystal clear and empty. Meg blinked at the blurred figures of Charles and her father and wondered why they did not clear. Then she grabbed her own glasses out of her pocket and put them on, and her myopic eyes were able to focus. Charles Wallace was tapping one foot impatiently against the floor.
It is not pleased, he said. It is not pleased at all.
Mr. Murray released Meg and knelt in front of the little boy.
Charles? His voice was tender. Charles Wallace?
What do you want?
I'm your father, Charles. Look at me.
The pale blue eyes seemed to focus on Mr. Murray's face.
Hi, Pop,
came an insolent voice.
That isn't Charles, Meg cried. Oh, Father, Charles isn't like that. It has him.
Yes, Mr. Murray sounded tired. I see.
He held his arms out.
Charles, come here.
Father will make it all right, Meg thought. Everything will be all right now.
Charles did not move toward the outstretched arms. He stood a few feet away from his father, and he did not look at him.
Look at me, Mr. Murray commanded.
No.
Mr. Murray's voice became harsh.
When you speak to me, you will say, no, father, or no, sir.
Come off it, Pop,
came the cold voice from Charles Wallace. Charles Wallace, who outside Kamazots had been strange, had been different, but never rude.
You're not the boss around here.
Meg could see Calvin pounding again on the glass wall.
Calvin! She called.
He can't hear you, Charles said.
He made a horrible face at Calvin, and then he thumbed his nose.
Who's Calvin? Mr. Murray asked.
He's...
Meg started, but Charles Wallace cut her short.
You'll have to defer your explanations. Let's go.
Go where?
To it.
No, Mr. Murray said, you can't take Meg there.
Oh, can't I?
No, you cannot. You're my son, Charles, and I'm afraid you will have to do as I say.
But he isn't Charles, Meg cried in anguish. Why didn't her father understand? Charles is nothing like that, Father. You know he's nothing like that.
He was only a baby when I left, Mr. Murray said heavily.
Father, it's it talking through Charles. It isn't Charles. He's bewitched.
Fairy tales again, Charles said.
You know it, Father? Meg asked.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
Yes, Meg.
Again, his voice sounded exhausted.
Yes, I have.
He turned to Charles.
You know she wouldn't be able to hold out.
Exactly, Charles said.
Father, you can't talk to him as though he were Charles. Ask Calvin. Calvin will tell you.
Come along, Charles Wallace said. We must go.
He held up his hand carelessly and walked out of the cell, and there was nothing for Meg and Mr. Murray to do but to follow. As they stepped into the corridor, Meg caught at her father's sleeve.
Calvin! Here's Father!
Calvin turned anxiously toward them. His freckles and his hair stood out brilliantly against his white face.
Make your introductions later, Charles Wallace said. It does not like to be kept waiting.
He walked down the corridor, his gait seeming to get more jerky with each step. The others followed, walking rapidly to keep up.
Does your father know about the Mrs. W's? Calvin asked Meg.
There hasn't been time for anything. Everything's awful.
Despair settled like a stone in the pit of Meg's stomach. She had been so certain that the moment she found her father, everything would be all right. Everything would be settled. All the problems would be taken out of her hands. She would no longer be responsible for anything. And instead of this happy and expected outcome, they seemed to be encountering all kinds of new troubles.
He doesn't understand about Charles, she whispered to Calvin,
looking unhappily at her father's back as he walked behind the little boy.
Where are we going?
Calvin asked.
To it. Calvin, I don't want to go. I can't.
She stopped, but Charles continued his jerky pace.
We can't leave Charles, Calvin said. They wouldn't like it.
Who wouldn't?
Mrs. What's-it and company.
But they've betrayed us. They brought us here to this terrible place and abandoned us.
Calvin looked at her in surprise.
You sit down and give up if you like, he said. I'm sticking with Charles.
He ran to keep up with Charles Wallace and Mr. Murray.
I didn't mean...
Meg started and pounded after them. Just as she caught up with them, Charles Wallace stopped and raised his hand, and there was the elevator again, its yellow light sinister. Meg felt her stomach jerk as the swift descent began. They were silent until the motion stopped, silent as they followed Charles Wallace through long corridors and out into the street. The central intelligence building loomed up, stark and angular behind them.
Do something,
Meg implored her father silently.
Do something. Help. Save us.
They turned a corner, and at the end of the street was a strange dome-like building. Its walls glowed with a flicker of violet flame. Its silvery roof pulsed with ominous light. The light was neither warm nor cold, but it seemed to reach out and touch them. This, Meg was sure, must be where it was waiting for them. They moved down the street more slowly now, and as they came closer to the domed building, the violet flickering seemed to reach out, to envelop them, to suck them in. They were inside. Meg could feel a rhythmical pulsing. It was a pulsing not only about her, but in her as well. As though the rhythm of her heart and lungs was no longer her own, but was being worked by some outside force. The closest she had come to the feeling before
was when she had been practicing artificial respiration with Girl Scouts, and the leader, an immensely powerful woman, had been working on Meg, intoning, "Out goes the bad air, in comes the good," while her heavy hands pressed, released. Meg gasped, trying to breathe at her own normal rate, but the inexorable beat within and without continued. For a moment, she could neither move nor look around to see what was happening to the others. She simply had to stand there, trying to balance herself into the artificial rhythm of her heart and lungs. Her eyes seemed to swim in a sea of red. Then things began to clear, and she could breathe without gasping like a beached fish, and she could look about the great, circular, domed building. It was completely empty, except for the pulse, which seemed a tangible thing, and a round dais exactly in the center. On the dais lay what? Meg could not tell, and yet she knew that it was from this that the rhythm came. She stepped forward, tentatively. She felt that she was beyond fear now. Charles Wallace was no longer Charles Wallace. Her father had been found, but he had not made everything all right. Instead, everything was worse than ever, and her adored father was bearded and thin and white and not omnipotent after all. No matter what happened next, things could be no more terrible or frightening than they already were. Oh, couldn't they? As she continued to step slowly forward, at last she realized what the thing on the dais was. It was a brain. A disembodied brain. An oversized brain, just enough larger than normal to be completely revolting and terrifying. A living brain. A brain that pulsed and quivered, that seized and commanded. No wonder the brain was called it. It was the most horrible, the most repellent thing she had ever seen, far more nauseating than anything she had ever imagined with her conscious mind, or that had ever tormented her in her most terrible nightmares. But as she had felt she was beyond fear, so now she was beyond screaming. She looked at Charles Wallace, and he stood there, turned towards it, his jaw hanging slightly loose, and his vacant blue eyes slowly twirled. Oh, yes, things could always be worse. These twirling eyes within Charles Wallace's soft, round face made Meg icy cold inside and out. She looked away from Charles Wallace and at her father. Her father stood there, with Mrs. Hu's glasses still perched on his nose. Did he remember that he had them on? And he shouted to Calvin, "Don't give in!" "I won't! Help Meg!" Calvin yelled back. It was absolutely silent within the dome, and yet Meg realized that the only way to speak was to shout with all the power possible. For everywhere she looked, everywhere she turned, was the rhythm. And as it continued to control the systole and diastole of her heart, the intake and outlet of her breath, the red miasma began to creep before her eyes again, and she was afraid that she was going to lose consciousness, and if she did, that she would be completely in the power of it. Mrs. Watsit had said, "Meg, I give you your faults." What were her greatest faults? Anger? Impatience? Stubbornness? Yes, it was to her faults that she turned to save herself now. With an immense effort, she tried to breathe against the rhythm of it. But its power was too strong. Each time she managed to take a breath out of rhythm, an iron hand seemed to squeeze her heart and lungs. Then she remembered that when they had been standing before the man with red eyes, and the man with red eyes had been intoning the multiplication table at them, Charles Wallace had fought against his power by shouting out nursery rhymes, and Calvin by the Gettysburg Address. "Georgie Porgie, Puddin' and Pie," she yelled. "Kissed the girls and made them cry."
That was no good. It was too easy for nursery rhymes to fall into the rhythm of it.
She didn't know the Gettysburg Address. How did the Declaration of Independence begin? She had memorized it only that winter, not because she was required to at school, but simply because she liked it. "We hold these truths to be self-evident," she shouted, "that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." As she cried out the words, she felt a mind moving in on her own, felt it seizing, squeezing her brain. Then she realized that Charles Wallace was speaking, or being spoken through by it.
"But that's exactly what we have on Kamazats. Complete equality. Everybody exactly alike."
For a moment, her brain reeled with confusion. Then came a moment of blazing truth. "No," she cried triumphantly. "Like and equal are not the same thing at all." "Good girl, Meg," her father shouted at her. But Charles Wallace continued as though there had been no interruption.
"In Kamazats, all are equal. In Kamazats, everybody is the same as everybody else."
But he gave her no argument, provided no answer, and she held on to her moment of revelation. "Like and equal are two entirely different things." For the moment, she had escaped from the power of it. But how? She knew that her own puny little brain was no match for this great, bodiless, pulsing, writhing mass on the round dais. She shuddered as she looked at it. In the lab at school, there was a human brain preserved in formaldehyde, and the seniors preparing for college had to take it out and look at it and study it. Meg had felt that when that day came, she would never be able to endure it. But now she thought that if only she had a dissecting knife, she would slash at it, cutting ruthlessly through cerebrum, cerebellum. Words spoke within her, directly this time, not through Charles.
"Don't you realize that if you destroy me, you also destroy your little brother?"
If that great brain were cut, were crushed, would every mind under its control on Kamazats die, too? Charles Wallace, and the man with red eyes, and the man who ran the number one spelling machine on the second grade level, and all the children playing ball and skipping rope, and all the mothers and all the men and women going in and out of the buildings? Was their life completely dependent on it? Were they beyond all possibility of salvation? She felt the brain reaching at her again as she let her stubborn control slip. Red fog glazed her eyes. Faintly, she heard her father's voice, though she knew he was shouting at the top of his lungs.
"The periodic table of elements, Meg. Say it."
A picture flashed into her mind of winter evenings spent sitting before the open fire and studying with her father. "Hydrogen. Helium," she started obediently. "Keep them in their proper atomic order. What next?" She knew it, yes. "Lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine." She shouted the words at her father, turned away from it. "Neon, sodium, magnesium, aluminum, silicon, phosphorus."
"Too rhythmical," her father shouted. "What's the square root of 5?
For a moment, she was able to concentrate. "Rack your brains yourself, Meg. Don't let it rack them."
"The square root of 5 is 2.236, she cried triumphantly, "because 2.236 times 2.236 equals 5.
"What's the square root of 7?
"The square root of 7 is..." She broke off. She wasn't holding out. It was getting at her, and she couldn't concentrate, not even on math, and soon she, too, would be absorbed in it. She would be an it.
"Tesser, sir,"
she heard Calvin's voice through the red darkness.
Tesser!
She felt her father grab her by the wrist. There was a terrible jerk that seemed to break every bone in her body. Then the dark nothing of Tessering. If Tessering with Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch had been a strange and fearful experience, it was nothing like Tessering with her father. After all, Mrs. Witch was experienced at it, and Mr. Murray, how did he know anything about it at all? Meg felt that she was being torn apart by a whirlwind. She was lost in an agony of pain that finally dissolved into the darkness of complete unconsciousness. Chapter 10. Absolute Zero. The first sign of returning consciousness was cold, then sound. She was aware of voices that seemed to be traveling through her across an arctic waste. Slowly, the icy sounds cleared, and she realized that the voices belonged to her father and Calvin. She did not hear Charles Wallace. She tried to open her eyes, but the lids would not move. She tried to sit up, but she could not stir. She struggled to turn over, to move her hands, her feet, but nothing happened. She knew that she had a body, but it was as lifeless as marble. She heard Calvin's frozen voice. "Her heart is beating so slowly." Her father's voice. "But it's beating. She's alive."
"Barely."
"We couldn't find a heartbeat at all. At first, we thought she was dead."
"Yes."
"And then we could feel her heart very faintly, the beats very far apart, and then it got stronger, so all we have to do is wait."
Her father's words sounded brittle in her ears, as though they were being chipped out of ice. "Calvin."
"Yes, you're right, sir."
She wanted to call out to them, "I'm alive, I'm very much alive, only I've been turned to stone." But she could not call out any more than she could move. Calvin's voice again.
"Anyhow, you got her away from it. You got us both away, and we couldn't have gone on holding out. It's so much more powerful and strong than..." "How did we stay out, sir? How did we manage as long as we did?"
Her father. "Because it's completely unused to being refused. That's the only reason I could keep from being absorbed, too. No mind has tried to hold out against it for so many thousands of centuries that certain centers have become soft and atrophied through lack of use. If you hadn't come to me when you did, I'm not sure how much longer I would have lasted. I was on the point of giving in."
Calvin.
"Oh, no, sir."
Her father.
"Yes. Nothing seemed important anymore but rest. And of course, it offered me complete rest. I had almost come to the conclusion that I was wrong to fight, that it was right after all, and everything I believed in most passionately was nothing but a madman's dream. But then you and Meg came into me, broke through my prison, and hope and faith returned."
Calvin.
"Sir, why were you on Kamazuts at all? Was there a particular reason for going there?"
Her father, with a frigid laugh.
"Going to Kamazuts was a complete accident. I never intended even to leave our own solar system. I was heading for Mars. Tessering is even more complicated than we had expected."
Calvin.
"Sir, how was it able to get Charles Wallace before it got Meg and me?"
Her father.
"From what you've told me, it's because Charles Wallace thought he could deliberately go into it and return. He trusted too much to his own strength. Listen, I think the heartbeat is getting stronger."
His words no longer sounded to her quite as frozen. Was it his words that were ice or her ears? Why did she hear only her father and Calvin? Why didn't Charles Wallace speak?
Silence. A long silence. Then Calvin's voice again.
Can't we do anything? Can't we look for help? Do we just have to go on waiting?
Her father, we can't leave her, and we must stay together. We must not be afraid to take time.
Calvin, you mean we were? We rushed into things on Kamazats too fast, and Charles Wallace rushed in too fast, and that's why he got caught?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I don't know enough yet. Time is different on Kamazats anyhow. Our time, inadequate though it is, at least is straightforward. It may not be even fully one-dimensional because it can't move back and forth on its line, only ahead, but at least it's consistent in its direction. Time on Kamazats seems to be inverted, turned in on itself. So I have no idea whether I was imprisoned in that column for centuries or only for minutes.
Silence for a moment. Then her father's voice again.
I think I feel a pulse in her wrist now.
Meg could not feel his fingers against her wrist. She could not feel her wrist at all. Her body was still stone, but her mind was beginning to be capable of movement. She tried desperately to make some kind of a sound, a signal to them, but nothing happened. Their voices started again.
Calvin. About your project, sir. Were you on it alone?
Her father. Oh, no. There were half a dozen of us working on it, and I dare say a number of others we don't know about. Certainly we weren't the only nation to investigate along that line. It's not really a new idea.
But we did try very hard not to let it be known abroad that we were trying to make it practicable. Did you come to Kamazats alone, or were there others with you?
I came alone. You see, Calvin, there was no way to try it out ahead with rats or monkeys or dogs, and we had no idea whether it would really work or whether it would be complete bodily disintegration. Playing with time and space is a dangerous game.
But why you, sir?
I wasn't the first. We drew straws, and I was second.
What happened to the first man?
We don't... Look, did her eyelids move?
Silence, then.
No, it was only a shadow.
But I did blink, Meg tried to tell them. I'm sure I did. And I can hear you. Do something.
But there was only another long silence, during which perhaps they were looking at her, watching for another shadow, another flicker. Then she heard her father's voice again, quiet, a little warmer, more like his own voice.
We drew straws, and I was second. We know Hank went. We saw him go. We saw him vanish right in front of the rest of us. He was there, and then he wasn't. We were to wait for a year for his return or for some message. We waited. Nothing.
Calvin, his voice cracking.
Jeepers, sir, you must have been in sort of a flap.
Yes, it's a frightening as well as an exciting thing to discover that matter and energy are the same thing, that size is an illusion, and that time is a material substance. We can know this, but it's far more than we can understand with our puny little brains. I think you will be able to comprehend far more than I, and Charles Wallace even more than you.
Yes, but what happened, please, sir, after the first man?
Meg could hear her father sigh.
Then it was my turn.
I went, and here I am, a wiser and a humbler man. I'm sure I haven't been gone 2 years. Now that you've come, I have some hope that I may be able to return in time. One thing I have to tell the others is that we know nothing.
Calvin.
What do you mean, sir?
Her father.
Just what I say. We're children, playing with dynamite. In our mad rush, we've plunged into this before.
With a desperate effort, Meg made a sound. It wasn't a very loud sound, but it was a sound. Mr. Murray stopped.
Hush, listen.
Meg made a strange croaking noise. She found that she could pull open her eyelids. They felt heavier than marble, but she managed to raise them. Her father and Calvin were hovering over her. She did not see Charles Wallace. Where was he?
She was lying in an open field of what looked like rusty, stubby grass. She blinked, slowly and with difficulty.
"Meg," her father said. "Meg, are you all right?"
Her tongue felt like a stone tongue in her mouth, but she managed to croak.
"I can't move."
"Try,"
Calvin urged. He sounded now as though he were very angry with her.
"Wiggle your toes, wiggle your fingers."
"I can't. Where's Charles Wallace?"
Her words were blunted by the stone tongue. Perhaps they could not understand her, for there was no answer.
"We were knocked out for a minute, too," Calvin was saying. "You'll be all right, Meg. Don't get panicky."
He was crouched over her, and though his voice continued to sound cross, he was peering at her with anxious eyes. She knew that she must still have her glasses on because she could see him clearly. His freckles, his stubby black lashes, the bright blue of his eyes. Her father was kneeling on her other side. The round lenses of Mrs. Hu's glasses still blurred his eyes. He took one of her hands and rubbed it between his.
"Can you feel my fingers?"
He sounded quite calm, as though there were nothing extraordinary in having her completely paralyzed. At the quiet of his voice, she felt calmer. Then she saw that there were great drops of sweat standing out on his forehead, and she noticed vaguely that the gentle breeze that touched her cheeks was cool. At first his words had been frozen, and now the wind was mild. Was it icy cold here, or warm?
"Can you feel my fingers?" he asked again.
Yes. Now she could feel a pressure against her wrist, but she could not nod.
"Where's Charles Wallace?"
Her words were a little less blurred. Her tongue, her lips were beginning to feel cold and numb, as though she had been given a massive dose of Novocaine at the dentist's. She realized with a start that her body and limbs were cold, that not only was she not warm, she was frozen from head to toe, and it was this that had made her father's words seem like ice that had paralyzed her.
"I'm frozen," she said faintly.
Kamazots hadn't been this cold, a cold that cut deeper than the wind on the bitterest of winter days at home. She was away from it, but this unexplained iciness was almost as bad. Her father had not saved her. Now she was able to look around a little, and everything she could see was rusty and gray. There were trees edging the field in which she lay, and their leaves were the same brown as the grass. There were plants that might have been flowers, except that they were dull and gray. In contrast to the drabness of color, to the cold that numbed her, the air was filled with a delicate, spring-like fragrance, almost imperceptible as it blew softly against her face. She looked at her father and Calvin. They were both in their shirt sleeves and looked perfectly comfortable. It was she, wrapped in their clothes, who was frozen too solid even to shiver.
"Why am I so cold?" she asked. "Where's Charles Wallace?"
They did not answer.
"Father, where are we?"
Mr. Murray looked at her soberly.
"I don't know, Meg. I don't test her very well. I must have overshot somehow. We're not on Kamazots. I don't know where we are. I think you're so cold because we went through the black thing, and I thought for a moment it was going to tear you away from me."
"Is this a dark planet?"
Slowly her tongue was beginning to thaw, her words were less blurred.
"I don't think so," Mr. Murray said, "but I know so little about anything that I can't be sure."
"You shouldn't have tried to test her then."
She had never spoken to her father in this way before. The words seemed hardly to be hers. Calvin looked at her, shaking his head.
"It was the only thing to do. At least it got us off Kamazots."
"Why did we go without Charles Wallace? Did we just leave him there?"
The words that were not really hers came out cold and accusing.
"We didn't just leave him," her father said. Remember that the human brain is a very delicate organism, and it can be easily damaged.
See, Meg?
Calvin crouched over her, tense and worried.
If your father had tried to yank Charles away when he tested us, and if it had kept grabbing hold of Charles, it might have been too much for him and we'd have lost him forever, and we had to do something right then.
Why?
It was taking us. You and I were slipping. And if your father had gone on trying to help us, he wouldn't have been able to hold out much longer either.
You told him to tesser,
Meg charged Calvin. There isn't any question of blame, Mr. Murray cut in severely. Can you move yet? All Meg's faults were uppermost in her now, and they were no longer helping her.
No, and you better take me back to Kamazots and Charles Wallace quickly. You're supposed to be able to help.
Disappointment was as dark and corrosive in her as the black thing. The ugly words tumbled from her cold lips, even as she herself could not believe that it was to her father, her beloved, longed-for father, that she was talking to in this way. If her tears had not still been frozen, they would have gushed from her eyes. She had found her father, and he had not made everything all right. Everything kept getting worse and worse. If the long search for her father was ended, and he wasn't able to overcome all their difficulties, there was nothing to guarantee that it would all come out right in the end. There was nothing left to hope for. She was frozen, and Charles Wallace was being devoured by it, and her omnipotent father was doing nothing. She teetered on the seesaw of love and hate, and the black thing pushed her down into hate.
You don't even know where we are, she cried out at her father. We'll never see Mother or the twins again. We don't know where Earth is or even where Kamazots is. We're lost out in space. What are you going to do?
She did not realize that she was as much in the power of the black thing as Charles Wallace. Mr. Murray bent over her, massaging her cold fingers. She could not see his face.
My daughter, I am not a Mrs. What's-it, a Mrs. Who, or a Mrs. Which. Yes, Calvin has told me everything he could. I am a human being, and a very fallible one, but I agree with Calvin. We were sent here for something, and we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose.
The black thing, Meg cried out at him. Why did you let it almost get me?
You've never tessered as well as the rest of us, Calvin reminded her. It never bothered Charles and me as much as it did you.
He shouldn't have taken me then, Meg said, until he learned to do it better.
Neither her father nor Calvin spoke. Her father continued his gentle massage. Her fingers came back to life with tingling pain.
You're hurting me.
Then you're feeling again, her father said quietly. I'm afraid it is going to hurt, Meg.
The piercing pain moved slowly up her arms, began in her toes and legs. She started to cry out against her father when Calvin exclaimed,
Look!
Coming towards them, moving in silence across the brown grass, were three figures. What were they? On Uriel, there had been the magnificent creatures. On Kamazots, the inhabitants had at least resembled people. What were these three strange things approaching? They were the same dull gray color as the flowers. If they hadn't walked upright, they would have seemed like animals. They moved directly toward the three human beings. They had four arms and far more than five fingers to each hand. And the fingers were not fingers, but long, waving tentacles. They had heads and they had faces. But where the faces of the creatures on Uriel had seemed far more than human faces, these seemed far less. Where the features would normally be, there were several indentations, and in place of ears and hair, there were more tentacles. They were tall, Meg realized as they came closer, far taller than any man. They had no eyes, just soft indentations. Meg's rigid, frozen body tried to shudder with terror, but instead of the shudder, all that came was pain. She moaned. The things stood over them. They appeared to be looking down at them, except that they had no eyes with which to see. Mr. Murray continued to kneel by Meg, massaging her.
He's killed us, bringing us here, Meg thought. I'll never see Charles Wallace again, or Mother, or the twins.
Calvin rose to his feet. He bowed to the beasts as though they could see him. He said,
"How do you do, sir, ma'am?"
"Who are you?" the tallest of the beasts said. His voice was neither hostile nor welcoming, and it came not from the mouth-like indentation in the furry face, but from the waving tentacles.
"They'll eat us," Meg thought wildly. "They're making me hurt. My toes, my fingers, I hurt."
Calvin answered the beast's question.
We're from Earth. I'm not sure how we got here. We've had an accident. Meg, this girl, is paralyzed. She can't move. She's terribly cold. We think that's why she can't move."
One of them came up to Meg and squatted down on its huge haunches beside her, and she felt utter loathing and revulsion as it reached out a tentacle to touch her face. But with the tentacle came the same delicate fragrance that moved across her with the breeze, and she felt a soft, tingling warmth go all through her that momentarily assuaged her pain. She felt suddenly sleepy. "I must look as strange to it as it looks to me," she thought drowsily, and then realized with a shock that of course the beast couldn't see her at all. Nevertheless, a reassuring sense of safety flowed through her with the warmth which continued to seep deep into her as the beast touched her. Then it picked her up, cradling her in two of its four arms. Mr. Murray stood up quickly.
"What are you doing?"
"Taking the child." Chapter 11, Aunt Beast.
"No," Mr. Murray said sharply. "Please put her down."
A sense of amusement seemed to emanate from the beasts. The tallest, who seemed to be the spokesman, said,
"We frighten you?"
"What are you going to do with us?"
Mr. Murray asked. The beast said,
"I'm sorry, we communicate better with the other one."
He turned toward Calvin.
"Who are you?"
"I'm Calvin O'Keefe."
"What's that?"
"I'm a boy, a young man."
"You too are afraid?"
"I'm not sure."
"Tell me," the beast said, "what do you suppose you'd do if three of us suddenly arrived on your home planet?"
"Shoot you, I guess," Calvin admitted.
"Then isn't that what we should do with you?"
Calvin's freckles seemed to deepen, but he answered quietly,
"I'd really rather you didn't. I mean, the Earth's my home, and I'd rather be there than anywhere in the world. I mean, the universe, and I can't wait to get back. But we make some awful bloopers there."
The smallest beast, the one holding Meg, said,
"And perhaps they aren't used to visitors from other planets."
"Used to it?" Calvin exclaimed. "We've never had any as far as I know."
"Why?"
"I don't know."
The middle beast, a tremor of trepidation in his words, said,
"You aren't from a dark planet, are you?"
"No."
Calvin shook his head firmly, though the beast couldn't see him.
We're shadowed, but we're fighting the shadow."
The beast holding Meg questioned,
"You three are fighting?"
"Yes,"
Calvin answered.
"Now that we know about it."
The tall one turned back to Mr. Murray, speaking sternly.
"You, the oldest man, from where have you come now?"
Mr. Murray answered steadily. From a planet called Kamazots. There was a mutter from the three beasts. We do not